Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House of the Rising Sun with Lynn and Bruce. And I have Bruce on the Skype from sunny California, I suppose. And
yes.
Lynn, you're in 6 inches deep in water, Pueblo. And but I'm going to just mute my mic and let Bruce say hello and maybe start talking about what we want to talk about today while I call the water department. So this mic is all yours.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn, and good morning, all. And hope you can get a hold of the water department. As Rosanna Dennis says, it's always something. And so that's why when I was putting together amusing quotes for the second book I put out, gosh, it's been, I think, 4 or 5 years already now. I juxtaposed that with a quote from Gene Bogart, who's the gracious and eloquent MC of Gary Renard's podcast. And Gene's quote was, "It's always nothing." I thought those two quotes worked together very nicely, as Gilda Radner's very whimsical quote about egos, "Seek but do not find," and put in other words, and the Holy Spirit's "Seek and always find." It's all a matter of which thought system we approach it with, isn't it? So, I thought, since we've been on a roll with these FAQs, it would be good to read yet another one. And they're all good. So what Lynn and I have been doing for quite some time, with a few exceptions, for, gosh, since last autumn, I believe, for the most part, reading from the frequently asked questions from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. And their website is facim.org. And you can go a little bit more directly to the Q&As sections by just going to facimoutreach.org. That's facimoutreach.org. And then there's the Q&A listings there that they're chronological. And those also are the numerically ordered ones. There's like over 1,300 of them. They're just wonderful. They're all really good. I was kind of joke with people that I'm in the Will Rogers school of Ken Wapnick, and that I never met one I didn't like, and these FAQs are no exception. They're just brilliant and very well written, and address from a course perspective just everyday questions that we all have, and they cover a lot of ground. they're really quite impressive, and in a very humble way, because they don't really purport to be the be-all, end-all answer, but yet they seem like they cover so much ground here. So I'm going to read question number 1191. That's 1191 in the FAQs. And hopefully Lynn will have called the water department and taken care of the neighbor flooding issue, or at least got that in process by the time I get done with reading the question. And maybe if not, I'll read the first paragraph and talk about it. So anyway, but these questions are all really wonderful, and they address so much of what goes on in our lives. So just as a quick aside, I usually do this at the end, but maybe I'll do this at the start this time. For people that are interested in some of the other conversations that Lynn and I have done, as well as other conversations with C.A. Brooks, who has a wonderful show on 1-2 Radio once a week about A Course in Miracles, that I take the audio recordings from those, just posted one last night. And I also have an email list on acimblog.com if you want to get on that list, and you'll get those automatically the next day. So I post things such as those and the conversations that Lynn and I do every week, and also monthly conversations with Susan Dugan, approximately monthly, varies. And those are done on my YouTube channel, so those are video. But audio works fine with those too, of course, because it's really mostly just the conversation. And just anything else I can find. So if anyone has things that are kind of in line with I hesitate to use hardcore, but the authentic metaphysics of A Course in Miracles, that's the kind of stuff I really like to post on ACIM blog. So, for example, I have a lot of stuff on there, as much as I can find, and I have a backlog of audio, kind of reminding myself, thinking out loud, I have a backlog of audio files to do a little finished editing on from Doug Sparks, but I posted several there. If you put Doug Sparks in the the search box on ACIMblog.com, you'll find a few links to two or three, I think, of his audio talks. He's a course teacher that has studied with Ken originally when early on in Ken's work, and has really taken to heart the teachings that he learned and apply them. He's just a wonderful person to be around, as is his wife, Nisa. They live in Boulder, Colorado. I've gone to a number of his talks at Rocky Mountain Miracle Center, which is also a wonderful venue. I'm just doing a little filler this morning, just for fun, because it's things that I think other course students might really appreciate, particularly if you're in the Denver area, which is where I'm heading back to in just a little over a month from now. Having been a year in California here, helping my mom out with some medical recovery, and she's doing great. I'm happy to report. Anyway, this really is a string of facts.
Okay, I'm back.
You're back.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I was doing a little filler. I was doing a little filler, and I'll conclude with saying that on the ACIM blog site, there's also a link in the upper left hand corner to another event that course students might want to avail themselves. I was thinking I just do my little promos at the beginning rather than the end this time. The third annual virtual A Course in Miracles conference put on by the Miracle Share folks, Craig and Corinne and Danielle, and they do a great job with it. And they've invited wonderful folks again to share about 24 half-hour recordings, video recordings, conversations mostly. A few monologues. But I think the conversations are great because, you know, get the interaction just like you and I have discovered, Lynn. And then after that, there's a phone-in Q&A for a half hour. So you've got over 24 of these over a three-day period. And the beauty of a virtual conference is multifold. But first off, you don't have any travel expenses, you know, no airlines, no ground transportation, no meals and lodging, none of that kind of stuff. Although it's always fun to meet in person, this is such a great opportunity for people that may or may not have the means and or availability, schedule-wise, to go to a physical conference. And what's neat about – another thing that's neat about a virtual conference is if you happen to be busy that weekend in October, which is coming up in a couple months, for all or part of it, no big deal, because you can watch and listen to the entire conference anytime at your convenience on your computer from the comfort of wherever your computer's at, living room, bedroom, whatever.
Yeah. And the other thing too about the virtual share, if you do that, like the way that it's set up is it an hour long, each one of the talks?
Yeah, well, it's a half hour and then a half hour of Q&A with the live phone in. The live phone in, of course, you won't be able to access live. That's the only disadvantage of not having that weekend free. If you did want to call in and ask questions or make comments of the in response to the recorded video presentations, that will all be canned after that. But
correct. The thing that I was going to say about all that is that if you're listening to it and you're not listening to it from the recordings, it will cut off at 30 minutes, no matter what the person is saying. Uh-huh. So you could be right in the middle of some really, succinct, intelligent point, and it just cuts right off. So, but if you get the, if you actually get the recordings, you get to hear the whole thing. You don't hear the,
just
30 minutes and that's the end of it. So,
So
it is, it is good. The recording later is, I think, if you're not going to participate in the live Q&A, the recording is probably the best way to listen.
And I've made every attempt to try to have those the previous two and also in both in October virtual conferences available to me, and I've pretty much been able to hear most of them. But there's been a couple of instances, particularly in the last one, where I had things I just needed to do that weekend, and so I went back and listened to them. And several of them were just so helpful that I went and listened to them multiple times. And that's the beauty, again, which you can't usually do in a physical conference, unless you buy all the recordings kind of thing, and usually that's prohibitive. Because of the way they're doing this, it's very affordable, and not to say nothing of the travel and lodging and all those kind of expenses that just don't even enter in. So it's a great opportunity. So if people are the least bit interested, I highly recommend it. And I've personally enjoyed all of the presentations that the 24 plus presenters have done over the last couple of years, and look forward to participating again. So
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So, did you give me a link?
I did. Let me get it.
Okay.
Put it in the chat window again, just in case it didn't make it there. Let me grab the URL and paste it in the chat window. And there it is. Okay. So, yeah. This one that picks up almost exactly where, well, I think a couple of intervening ones, but very close to where we left off last week is FAQ 1191. And I'll just go ahead and read the question. This is from FACM.org's resources from their FAQ page. And these are all in numerical order, and we're just kind of going through them a little at a time. The first one starts... this one starts number 1191. My inclination has been for years to feel that I have enough work to do in personal encounters and relationships, and that I do not have to look for more issues coming from the media. How appropriate for an election year, huh? Or an Olympic year, if that's
what really
it's nowadays. Right? I am convinced that the world will not become a better place, and so, not in resignation, but happily, I turn to the only place to go in seriousness, which is inside, and do the work there. I am asking about this because I remember thinking that the world will change someday because of our inner work, and then we will see happy headlines instead of catastrophic headlines. Well, I'll just preface the three paragraphs of answers on this particular one with a comment that I've been listening to on one of Ken Wapnick's audios quite a bit lately, because it's on my phone, and that's one of very few recordings, and I haven't figured out how to do the upgrade, but I will. And he says, you know, the purpose of A Course in Miracles is not to have us suffer, but to have us realize how much we're already suffering and how much this world is not going to cut it for us, you know, and not to be upset when things don't go the way we, little w, want them to go, but to be, you know, gleefully, in a comparative way, gloating over when things do seem to work the way we want them to, you know, which is really what I call fake gratitude. But just to see that it's all the same, to see that illusion A equals illusion B equals illusion C. And the only thing that's going to really make us happy in a consistent and unchangeable way is to wake up completely from illusion. And I think that's what A Course in Miracles leads us to inexorably. And we won't really be happy until we take make that decision and take that step. And this is all a preliminary curriculum leading up to that ultimate choice that says, you know, I'd rather be happy than right. Right as an ego, which is sort of an oxymoron anyway. So anyway, do you want to read the first paragraph of the answer they give, Lynn? You still there? Hello, Lynn? Am I still there? Am I still here?
Yeah, I'm still here. I just have my mic muted and didn't realize it.
Oh, okay.
I was like,
I've done that before.
Yeah, many times. Me too. You know, this is really one of those. I'm just going to start even before I read this and just say something. There's probably going to be something in this paragraph about level confusion.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems
go ahead.
You know, when we're talking about, I think the world will change because I'm doing the inner work and I will see happy headlines instead of catastrophic headlines. You know what? That happy and catastrophic are the two reasons that you're unhappy. The idea that there's such a thing as happy and there's such a thing as not happy in what occurs in the world, that really is, you know, the primary thing. You know, it is a level confusion thing, and people do it all the time, and say, you know, I'm doing this work, the world should be better, and if I'm and you know, maybe I need to do this work and something else too to make the world. I mean, how am I going to make the world better? You know, it's.
That kind of ties into one of those quintessential phrases that I will paraphrase, you know, I think it's in the text somewhere, but it might be the workbook anyway. Who knows? Anyway, it's, you know, what if you realize this world is an illusion? What if you realize you made it up, you know?
Yeah.
And what would we really be invested in the outcome of any particular situation or relationship or job or health situation or yard flooding situation or, you know, bank accounts, you know, elections, Olympic teams winning from your country, you know, pick anything in current events. Pick anything that happens to be going on this planet collectively, this galaxy. I mean,
why stay local?
Think globally, act galactically, right? So,
it's every part of your mind.
Pan-galactically, yeah. But certainly it's the wonderful classroom that we have, that I keep coming back to, this sort of mathematical precision that, you know, we've made up this incredibly convoluted, complicated, horrifically nightmarish scenario called a life that involves a body and its care and feeding and nurturing and a rise and ascent and descent, and this sort of predictable trajectory from, as the, you know, the cliche is, from cradle to grave. And we make such a big deal out of the, you know, the poster child, puppet of ego's projected thought system and what befalls it or doesn't befall it, and the comparisons between different puppets, you know, on the stage of the mind, forgetting that it's a stage, and you know, like you say, Lynn, ultimately all of these questions and answers involve level confusion, because if we think that, and it's so easy to get caught up in it and just catch yourself, and I think that's a huge part of what this course is about, is forgiving ourselves when we get caught up in level confusion on a not only a daily basis but a moment to moment basis, as we go about our everyday, you know, laundry list of things that we need to do, whether it's calling a water department or working on a website or going to help a new, you know, my niece and her husband move to a new house because their landlord was previous landlord was a bit on, you know, playing with a not full deck and you know, just crazy stuff, you know, just all that kind of stuff, you know, and all the things that seem to fill our days are perfect classrooms. Every little twinge of thought, every little nuance of experience is a perfect forgiveness classroom for us to look at and to see how we try to change the world, how we try to manipulate a dream that we've taken to be so real. And you know, and certainly on the level of form, you know, it doesn't mean that we want to go live in a cave or you know, be spouting platitudes at every turn. It's an inner process. It really, you know, we shouldn't really behave or look, as Ken Wapnick says, much differently after, you know, studying the course for years and applying it, other than, you know, as it says, I think it's in the manifest, you know, you'll smile a little more frequently and your brow won't be so furrowed. Yeah. And maybe, you know, we'll just catch ourselves more often and interrupt the ego's director's cut on the DVD playing through our space-time script movie and say, oh yeah, that's pretty insane. I don't have to buy into that identity. That's just a script that on some level I forgot I wrote and forgot I signed up for, and I can afford to gently laugh, not at, but with everyone about how silly it is to take this world of separation seriously.
Exactly. Yeah. And when you are able to do that, Bruce, but what's happened with me is that the more I'm able to do that, the more I'm able to look at what appears to be my brother's acting insanely, mm-hmm. and recognize that it's my own ego that's placing that picture on them for me.
Exactly.
And then I can just look at them and say, they're just playing their part in the script.
Yeah.
You know, their job was to be the evil wizard. And my job was to be the you know, the sweet innocent character, you know, you know,
yeah.
Dorothy, or you know, whoever, you know, that's my job, or my job is to be the evil person, my job is to be the one who's oppressive, even though I'm not oppressive and I won't be oppressive, but you know, perhaps I'm in a position where I have to be oppressive, like I'm an admin on a chat room and I have to red dot people. You know, that doesn't mean that I'm here trying to look for people to red dot. It just happens to be my part, the thing I play. And
is the red dot the same as a black ball?
Yeah, it's the same as a black ball. Exactly. Okay. It's like, you know, telling you, you know, you can't communicate. That's, you know, what the job of the admin is, to say who can communicate and who can't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and people will say, well, you know, that, you know, you're hurting people, or you're trying to stop people from communicating, or, you know, they have all kinds of things personally that they think you're doing when you're just doing what you're supposed to be doing in the script. And it's nothing personal. That's what I love about this. There's nothing personal about any of it. And when you take the personality out of it, then you see it's just like a clockwork. It's just going on. And all I can do is watch it and love the being that is being represented by the character, knowing that that character is just a character in the script. And the script is just going on the way it goes on. And that's where, you know, then the whole, you talk about forgiveness, you know, okay. Because then you can actually see my brother did nothing. My brother's doing nothing. And when you recognize that nothing is really happening, that's when forgiveness comes about. That's the truth of forgiveness. It's not saying, oh, you are a jerk and I'm going to forgive you anyway. It's saying, you're not that jerk. That jerk is a character. What you are is so far beyond that, that it would be silly to accuse you of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see you from that level, then I recognize that, you know, nobody's personally responsible for any of the actions in the world. The only thing I'm personally responsible for is the way I see it, the way I react to it, and the way that I forgive it. And that's, talk about power. That's a real power right there. So let me see if I can start the paragraph, and listening still for the, I mean, in fact, I'm going to open the door in case the doorbell rings and the water guy is here.
Okay.
Hopefully he won't even come here. Hopefully he'll come here and see there's water running down the street in front of my house and go to the neighbor's house and shut their water off. And it's so funny because I was talking to the lady at the water department, in case you came in late, my yard is being flooded by my neighbor's sprinkler system. It's broken or something, and there's like 6 inches of water in my yard. So I'm waiting for the water department to come and help rectify the situation. You know, so that's my story for this morning. That's Lynn's story for this morning. Now, does that make the people behind me jerks because their water's running? No. Does that make them evil because they flooded my yard? No. Does that make me a victim because my yard is flooded? No. None of those things are true. And so this is where you begin to be able to untangle the web of lies that the ego has made, not to punish or make us sad or anything, but just to give me something to do on a Saturday morning when all I was going to do is walk out and take a look at my backyard, you know, to have to go into action mode and do all these things. That's really what the script is for. It's to then show me gently that, you know, of course, you know, nothing is wrong. Nothing has happened. Nothing is bad. You know, even if the water comes in and floods my basement, you know, that's, you know, would be difficult to deal with, but it would be something that would be still, you know, whatever happens is a part of the script and nobody's responsible for it. And we're all responsible for it. So.
As you're saying that, Lynn, I was thinking of the Beatles lyrics, and nothing to get hung about, you know, but that's only applicable if we identify with the spirit and the essence that we all share, that is eternal and doesn't change, But if we identify with what can change or what can seem to change in this incredibly sophisticated and world-class, you know, high production value 3D hologram, moving hologram that we call, you know, physical life, from that identification, there's nothing but, you know, the insanity of the sin, guilt, fear thought system and level confusion and wanting to fix a dream and the dysfunctional, tendency to think that there's things that we can do that will then make the dream screen, the way we want it, and the catastrophic headlines will be converted to happy headlines, as the question suggests, you know. And
right.
I was just going to say, and there's nothing wrong with wanting that and doing what we can as an expression of that kind thought system to alleviate and minimize the suffering. But when we realize that the real alleviation takes place in the mind and the behavior is just, or and hopefully should be, a reflection of that thought system, then, you know, we start shifting our identity and our values to the mind and where the real effectiveness is and where we actually can experience the peace that is talked about in the Course and the happiness, which is, I like to use the word euphoria for the things that come and go, because it's kind of more ephemeral. You know, the ego's fake happiness is always about something that's better than something else, or, you know, in terms of space, you know, whether it's someone else's misfortune and none of my own kind of thing. It sounds like a Western
yes.
song.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a song.
Get along, and get along, little ego. And then, you know, or if it's something in time, you know, it's like, well, I used to have this problem, now I don't. But you might be dreading having another problem or the same problem recurring. You know, it's like, it's always something in ego's insane world, isn't it?
It's always something. And so what I was going to say is that the catastrophic headline only seems catastrophic because we believe that something can go wrong and that there are people who are being hurt and that there are, and not that they're just being hurt because, you know, I've been hurt, you've been hurt, we survived everything, you know, we're here. But we imagine that other people's hurt or other people's suffering is so much worse than our suffering would be if we were in that situation. And we project this picture of a helplessness on the people around us. And, you know, I've had it happen to me where, you know, I've been coping perfectly with whatever bad situation happened. And like even when I had an accident and I'm sitting, you know, at the side of the highway and my knee is puffed up like a, it was like a watermelon. It was like, you know, from ramming into the dashboard of my car when I had a head-on collision with a huge utility truck, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sitting there in perfect peace. Even probably in shock too, but you know, in perfect peace, and everybody around me was acting like, you know, it was the worst thing that ever happened. Oh, they're panicking. Oh, you poor thing. You know, I'm calling people on the phone, my husband and at that time, you know, and another person, and I was saying, you know, come on down and get me. I'll be in the emergency at this hospital. You know, I'm all calm. I'm telling them, I'm trying to help them calm down. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to help them. I'm the one who was hurt, and I'm trying to ease their suffering over what they are imagining is happening to me. And I end up being the one who's, you know, calm and soothing to people when I'm the one who was, quote unquote, the victim. That's how it works. People always assume that whatever's happening is so much worse and so bad that you couldn't possibly cope with it. They can't imagine they could cope with it, and therefore they project all this suffering onto you. But in reality, you're not suffering. Who you are is never suffering. And who I was at that moment wasn't suffering. I wasn't projecting, you know, what's going to happen. You know, my car's destroyed, my knee's destroyed. My, you know, I wasn't thinking any of those things because I was right then at that moment. I wasn't looking into the future. I wasn't thinking, oh my gosh, if I hadn't only left Moscow an hour earlier. I wasn't thinking any of those things. And so this is where we get tangled up, is in trying to imagine or second guess or whatever what another person is going through, and in our imagination it becomes much worse than it really is. Mm-hmm. So when I look at things that say catastrophe, like, you know, flooding, people dying, earthquakes, tsunamis, I mean, there's some horrible things that happen catastrophe wise that if it was happening right now, if I looked out my window and there was a wall of water coming up from a tsunami, and I knew that, you know, me and my entire household were going to be drowned in, you know, 30 seconds, I can tell you my suffering would not be as people on the other end of the world would imagine when they're looking at the headline. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd be having an individual experience that would be my individual experience, not a shared experience with everyone in the world. Not the entire world is suffering. And I keep thinking every time I say this about Star Wars, when they're on the Millennium Falcon and Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, gets this look and he looks all shocked and everything. And I think Luke says, you know, Ben, what's happening? And he says, I just got this, you know, feeling that, you know, billions of people screamed out in terror, and then it was gone. And that was, of course, when they blew up Alderaan and killed all those people. But those people were killed immediately. You know, they were vaporized. So they didn't have time to be afraid. They didn't have a time to panic and look for an escape route. They didn't have time to think about the future. They didn't have time to think about the past. They were just right there in that moment in their whatever. And so how could they have been afraid? You know, if you're in this very moment and not projecting past or future, you can't possibly be afraid. And for the most part, people who are in those kind of situations are in the moment. You know, they're not looking anywhere else. And so it might be the most peaceful moment of a person's life. The moment when the Death Star blows up their planet, you know, I know this sounds ridiculous, but we speculate and we project so much onto what we think the scenario is. Like when I said my backyard was flooded, how many people went, oh no, and thought about their own backyard and thought about what would happen and thought about me and felt bad for me. This is excess thinking that has no help. It's no help for anybody. And it's imaginary crap. So, anyway, enough of my diatribe. You know,
that was actually some really, you made some great points there. I thought were excellent. No need to apologize. In fact, I think a lot of the things you were saying, you know, that really reflect the idea that we assign and kind of tying into what you said earlier too is the, you know, the filtering that we do that distorts and changes. Yeah, years ago I read, a couple of books by Walter Russell, and I was, you know, impressed with a few of the ideas in there. One of them that he used was, you know, I think it was kind of alluding to, you know, the distortions of the ego mind, and he used the phrase mirrors and lenses. And I thought, well, that's kind of, you know, for that era, you have sort of an optical era, you know, when we had microscopes and telescopes before electronics started kicking in. You know, in that era, those are pretty good metaphors for the things that we use to either make bigger or smaller, or you know, which is basically comparing magnitudes of illusion again, not just the, you know, the left, right, up and down and forwards, backwards kind of stuff, but the in and out factors of magnification and zoom, if you will. And you go to a fun house and you see a different, you know, mirrors that warp things, and you realize, well, we do the same thing with our minds, but now we have electronic filters. You know, you can go into Photoshop and take a photo or a video and apply it to multiple frames, and add something that isn't there, or take something that is there and make it something else, or remove it, and do it with incredible finesse nowadays with things like content aware fill. I've used that on Photoshop all the time to get rid of things like power lines and telephone poles and things like, you know, this stuff like that. That if the photo would look quote unquote better with something removed and replaced with the sky or the trees or whatever behind it, you know, it's amazing what some of those things can do. But that's kind of what we do with our comparative mind, you know, the ego's mind that says, oh, it could be better if this were so. And it's, again, it's that whole ego trickery and propaganda of thinking, well, as long as we keep chasing the dream, if there's something on that list to do, and maybe the people that got hit with the Death Star, like you say in the Star Wars movie, were some of them might have been very gloriously happy to know that their to-do list was also vaporized, you know. but it's all a matter of perspective, isn't it? And we're so hung up on our little myopic vision of not only the world but also the idea that it could be a dream, that we forget that the whole victimizer paradigm is just part of that massive dream where there's good guys, bad guys, and better and lesser, and at the core of that is something different. And differences rely on a belief that separation was possible, that perfect oneness could possibly have been split or divided and fragmented, all these little individuals and bodies and galaxies and atoms and everything in between. And then we think somehow that actually happened because it's such a convincing hologram. But, you know, yes. It's just – anyway, yes. Do go yes. on now that I've rambled.
It's just amazing how when you start looking at how the fabric of this illusion is woven by your own imagination, and also, it all is based. And this is again here's Lynn back on her soapbox. When you look at every single one of these scenarios that you're imagining, and you trace it back to the root. You go back to that root cause analysis, right? And you trace it back to the root. What you're always going to come back to is, I feel guilt. Mm-hmm. I am guilty. It always comes back to, you know, the children are starving in Africa because I'm not taking care of them. The tsunami is killing all the villagers because, you know, we didn't get a warning system to them in time to get them out. The country's going to go to hell because, you know, Donald Trump is going to be president and he's going to nuke everybody. You know, these are, that's a joke. I'm kidding. But, it always comes down to somehow I'm responsible. If I voted for Jill Stein and Donald Trump gets to be president, who's going to be blaming me forever for having thrown away my
vote? People.
Yeah. See,
but that's how quickly our mind jumps back to that, and I couldn't help but laughing when you said this is Lynn in her soapbox. I was thinking, well, the truth of what you are and what I am. Is quietly laughing at the idea of there being a Lynn, there being a soapbox, there being a Bruce to be thinking of the response to the comment and the whole world and the whole mechanism by which everyone that we think is listening or now or in the future to a recording might be hopefully realizing, wait a minute, we're all the same self that can afford to laugh at the idea of Lynn and Bruce and other people and worlds and soapboxes within worlds and all that whole gamut of stuff, right?
Exactly. So let's read the answer to the question.
Let's
do it. What this question was?
Now,
do you guys remember
45
what the question
minutes.
Was?
Maybe we should reread the question. Let's do that.
Yeah. Okay. You want me to do it? I'll reread the question and the paragraph, the first answer. Okay. The question is, it's an 1191 in the FACIM outreach. And the question is, my inclination has been for years to feel that I have enough work to do in personal encounters and relationships and that I do not have to look for more issues coming from the media. I am convinced that the world will not become a better place, and so, not in resignation, but happily, I turn to the only place to go in seriousness, which is inside, and do the work there. Okay, I'm asking about this because I remember thinking that the world will change someday because of our inner work, and then we will see happy headlines instead of catastrophic headlines. So that's the question, you know, are we going to see happy headlines when our mind is changed? And, you know, it depends. Does tsunami kills 5 million people? Is that a happy headline to you? Because if it is, you will see that. And because you'll know there's no tsunamis and no people to be killed.
Well, yeah. I mean, our egos gloat on misfortune, you know, horrifically, because that's, but even though they put on the face of innocence to say, oh, no, I wouldn't wish that. But there's a part of everyone's ego that wants to have a justification for its existence, and anything that reinforces separation, which can include what seem to be catastrophes, is fair game for that egoic thought system.
Exactly. You know? And also it's not like it's a personal thing. You know, if I read thousands of people killed in a tsunami, I would be, oh, that's terrible. You know, that's really bad. If I see a picture of a drowned baby on a beach, I'm going to be devastated. So it's how it goes on a personal level, how I see it on a personal level and how it affects me. And, you know, there may be other people who see a drowned baby on a beach and say, oh, that's too bad. And you just go on. And there are other people who are taken by it, you know, that we must do something. But always you have this desire to have stopped that from happening, to never allowed that to happen. And that's all we're doing. We're trying to get back to where this never happened, because it never did. So let me see this answer. It seems as if you are reflecting the important principle of A Course in Miracles, quote, seek not to change the world, but choose to change your mind about the world. And that's from text chapter 21, the introduction. It is essential to understand this passage as pertaining only to content, not form. Okay, content, not form. What's in my mind, not what's in my body. What's not what's happening outside, not what's happening in the world. It's what the content of it is. The opening statement of the paragraph in which this quote appears provides its context. And this is so, this is one of those three-word sentences that Jesus uses to emphasize a point. And this point is, projection makes perception. And that's text 21, the introduction. Projection makes perception. This is the thrust of Jesus' teaching and in his training of us. He wants us to learn how to perceive correctly, which means learning to make a connection between our perception and the prior choice we made in our minds to identify with the ego thought system or the Holy Spirit's thought system. So he wants us to go back and look here. Oh, I'm seeing horrible things. Oh, what thought system am I identifying with? And that's all he wants us to do, is just look at that thought and identify which thought system am I looking at that with. And our interpretation of what our eyes see follows directly from that choice. If we identify with the thought system of forgiveness, we can look on scenes of overwhelming devastation and know that devastation has nothing to do with reality. And look in the workbook, part two. Let's see, what is that? It's hard for me to understand these. 13, was that lesson 13 maybe?
Yeah, workbook lesson 13. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yep. Well, okay. Speaking of which, they're actually on the new website. We're going to for Foundation for Inner Peace. There will be an annotation page that will describe how that notation works and how to use it. That is basically a complement to the one on the facim.org website.
Oh, cool.
So you can go to either website when we're done with the new site and look up, you know, search for annotation, if you can remember that word anyway, which is basically the references and parentheses that are used throughout these FAQs.
Very cool. Thank you. So, hey, Bruce, will there be links on those that you could just click and go to that thing?
That's in the work. That is in the work. works.
That's a lot of work.
Well, it is and it will be, but actually we have a brilliant programmer named Felix, who's in Munich, Germany, who has been helping with the workbook, the new workbook lessons. And he and I worked on that for several days and got that part of it knocked out, and it works beautifully. I'll send you the link. Cool. It's basically fully functional now, the new workbook. But what we haven't done yet, which I think is a really great idea that you just touched on, which was something that Felix suggested, and I thought, wow, light bulb idea, is have it so that when you hover over those annotations, it would not only pull a link to the place on the website where you can get the full text in context, but also you could copy it and paste it into your blog or your website, and have the link embedded in it. So that's one of our yes, we want to do this, but probably not for this first release of the new website. But it's on the list for sure, and an enthusiastic yes from myself and the programming genius that has been collaborating with me on this and contributed so much to the new website.
Excellent. That's wonderful. Yeah. That'll be cool. I love that idea. So I'm looking to the future for a solution. Thank you.
Yeah. And as we think of the oxymoron of all the things that we're doing in the world with A Course in Miracles, and remembering, of course, it's not the form. It's always the meaning behind the form.
You're making me think of Mel Brooks in, is it the History of the World? And he is... and he's Caesar.
Oh, they're different. Oh, Caesar. Okay.
And the guy has to go behind him and say, remember, you are human. Or something. I'll have to look that up and see what it is.
Okay.
Because his job is to remind him that he's not, a god, or that he's not, his job is to keep him centered, and anyway, it's cute.
Well, if you find a clip, send it to me. Yeah,
I'll find a clip and send it. So
some of that reminded me of a clip that actually could tie into this, and that is the simplicity of going beyond level confusion. It's kind of like the clip that I was reminded of when you mentioned that movie, where Moses goes up into the mountain with the thunder and lightning, and he says, you know, give us a sign, and then, of course, the movie version of God with the thunderous voice of the Old Testament speaks and says, here, take these 15, and it's on and three big heavy stones, and Mel Brooks as Moses, struggling to hold them, and one of them falls and crashes to the ground. Thank you, Lord, I will take these 15 10 commandments and give them to my people, you know. Anyway, we're always working towards simplifying, and I think the simplification is just, you know, I could choose peace instead of this, and that's probably the only, you know, if we just can get one good commandment like that going, we're probably good, you know, like Ken says, is that one, and, you know, I could see peace instead of this, and never upset for the reason I think. If you could just remember those two workbook lessons, you'd probably, you know, have the whole course sewn up, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's that simple.
It is.
It really is that simple. Oh my gosh! And yeah, look how complex we make it.
Oh yeah,
it's always
and look, how, and look how long we've taken to just get through one paragraph. But that's good. We've covered a lot of ground, I think. Yeah,
I still have two lines to read here.
I know. I'll let you know.
We will not be indifferent to the suffering of others. We will be at peace as we deal with the situations in our lives and the world, because we will know that pain and suffering do not define our reality. We will be in the world, but not of it. And those are some famous words that, I think, you know, Jesus maybe said, I don't know, but being in the world, but not of it really means that you're not caught up in the merry-go-round. You're not caught up in the illusion that, you know, you can actually, you know, look out and see that while there appears to be intense suffering, you may even look at your own self and say, you know, maybe you have a devastating disease, or, you know, you're homeless, or, you know, whatever your, you know, story is, you can look at that and just, you know, recognize, no, this is not, I'm not this. I'm not a body. I'm free. I'm still exactly what God made. You know, I know that doesn't rhyme, but it's true. I didn't change what God made. Nothing changed what God made. And when I realized that, that was a, you know, breakthrough moment for me, to just get that, you know, it doesn't matter what appears to be happening. God made perfection, and, you know, how could I change that? How could a tsunami change that? How can a baby, dead baby on a beach change that? You know, obviously there's a mistake in something in my thinking. And this is all this is pointing out, is a flaw in our thinking. So you want to go to the paragraph 2?
Sure.
Or you want to
talk
more about paragraph 1?
Well, actually, I do have one little quick thought about that last sentence. And that is that I think there's two important points in that last sentence that doesn't seem like it's, you know, too much of a distortion. one of those rare phrases that made it through and into the Bible relatively unscathed. The not of it part, I think, is real easy to get into a, you know, if we only focus on that, get into a denial state where, you know, we say, well, I don't need to express compassion or kindness because that doesn't affect me. Well, in the truth of what we are, yes, it doesn't affect the self that we are learning to identify with or re-identify with, which is what we always were. But the in the world part is the part that says, yeah, and while I appear to be here, if I'm not invested in outcomes, then I can afford to do things like hop in the car this afternoon and go help my evicted niece move into a new place with her husband and brother-in-law, you know, things like that, you know, or whatever seems to be, an appropriate thing to do on the level of form at the time, whether it's going to, a funeral or a wedding or just helping someone with compassion recognize that the things that seem to be going on in their life without necessarily saying a word even don't have to be devastating, don't have to be catastrophic. Just by the quality of presence that we share with everyone moment to moment. And that's where I think when we're not of it, by recognizing the eternal nature of the self we all share, that's when we teach that moment to moment and recognize that we're all teachers and we all have the capacity to share that awareness. So, enough of that. On to the second paragraph. The origin of the world is a thought of attack, and that's from Workbook Lesson 3. And therefore, it is not surprising that headlines constantly scream of disaster and catastrophe. That will continue until the mind of God's Son no longer is attracted to separation. When we are unwilling to pay the high price of being separate, we will ask for help to change our minds about our purpose for being here. And then the world will take on a different purpose. And that word purpose and intention, I think, are so important. And one of the things that in the last year or two that I've found really helpful in Ken Wapnick's teachings, among many things, is the idea that the Eastern mysticism gave us the idea of the world being illusion. And, of course, the miracles added to that the idea that it's purposive, that the ego wanted to try to escape, ineffectively, of course, the maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem, wanted to escape from the illusion that it made up by, you know, dividing it into further seeming fragments of that illusion and then trying to hide out in one fragment. You know, it's like, well, that's not going to work. But anyway, the world will take on a different purpose. It becomes a home in which forgiveness is born and where it grows and becomes stronger and more all-embracing. Here it is nourished, for here it is needed. And that's the different purpose. That's changing the ego's purpose to the purpose of forgiveness. When we look at everything that seems to happen to us and realizing it's coming from us, and then, you know, we reel it back into our expansive, inclusive definition of self, then there's nobody out there to forgive or blame. And then we take the next part of that equation and realize if it's based in space and time and a specific, then we're dealing with the illusion again. We're back to the metaphysic of the Course, and that's where forgiveness is justified, because from that perspective, above the battleground of duality, there isn't anything to forgive. There's no one out there to forgive, and there's nothing to forgive. And from that perspective, it becomes trivially easy, but only from that perspective, only from the that awareness that what we are could not possibly be at the mercy of anything that can change. Okay, and then it goes
that's
on.
That's beautiful. I love that what we are cannot possibly be at the mercy of something that could change.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, 'cause if we think that we are, then we're just, you know, we're back into the victim-victimizer role. And even our sympathy, which is, I kind of relegate to a more egoic word, where basically it says, yeah, the problem is real, and now I'm commiserating with you about it, instead of empathy, and this is just my own definition, where empathy can be a frame of mind where, you know, wherein we recognize that nothing happened, and it frees us up to behaviorally do something that could be helpful or say something that could be helpful without being invested in changing a situation, because we no longer are invested in the outcome, but we're invested in the kindness. We're invested in the wanting to see the shared interest and to feel the peace that truly has never been disrupted that we all share, and to share that. So, okay. Let me continue here. I'll read that last quoted sentence from the workbook, lesson 3. It becomes a home in which forgiveness is born and where it grows and becomes stronger and more all-embracing. Here is it nourished, for here it is needed. When every seemingly separate mind has at last accepted the atonement, the world will not become a better place with, quote, happy headlines, unquote. It will merely cease to seem to be. And those last two quotes are from section 14 of the Manual for Teachers. There will be no need for a world when there is no longer is any guilt in our minds that needs to be projected. Does that sound familiar, huh? The projection of unconscious guilt. But we needn't fear that the world will disappear before we are ready to leave it behind. As Ken says, you're not going to go poof. Fear not that you will be abruptly lifted up and hurled into reality. Time is kind, and if you use it on behalf of reality, it will keep gentle pace with you in your transition. The urgency is only in dislodging your mind from its fixed position here. And that sounds a whole lot like what you were doing, Lynn, when you described that automobile collision and how you responded to it by doing what needed to be done on the level of form as a reflection of the kindness in your mind, and it reflected in a behavioral way. But you sounds like you at that time had the sanity to recognize that the behavior was not the solution. It was the decision in the mind that was the answer. And then that allowed the full range of behavioral options that then you responded to. Is that
exactly? Exactly. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, you think, well, when I first started studying the Course, my mind was in such a disarray that I honestly was, you know, on the verge of suicide. But you think that you'll never get to the point where you could be absolutely at peace when things are happening that are seem to be devastating. But you really do come to that place because you do shift perspective and you actually are able to see. Because then you begin to see over and over and over that no matter what has occurred, no matter what has ever occurred to me in my life, I am still here, complete, whole, and intact. You know, I might have a bum knee. I might be blind in one eye. I might have all sorts of things physically that appear to be wrong with me. But there's nothing wrong with me. I am perfectly whole and have never changed. And I know that within myself. You know, my personality may have changed, my thoughts about things may have changed, but what I am at my core has always been the same. And I know this being from the very first thought that I ever had in my life that I can remember. I know this being is what I am. And so this, and I know that you are just like me. I know that everyone is just like me in that thing, that who you are has never changed and never will change. Even if the body and the personality and every the hair color, all those things have changed, it doesn't matter. Or hairless or hair, you know, it doesn't matter because that's not what you are. And yes. And so when you get to the core of what you are, then that's where, you know, the world can swirl around you. And everything is just fine. Everything is fine.
It is. It is.
It's, you know, I'm still standing. I'm still here. And
on the level of
even
the level of go ahead.
Oh, go. I was going to say even Stephen Hawking, and look at that man who appears to be in the most devastating condition a human could be in and still function. And he is all his mind, and he is still exactly who he ever was, and he is brilliant, and he is not limited. Not limited, even though the body itself is functions in absolutely no helpful way at all, other than to keep the brain alive. And so, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, when you get to this point where you are actually, you know, in that place of peace, it doesn't matter what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of my favorite Krishnamurti quotes, which I'm going to paraphrase, is it's been around Facebook lately, and I think I share it every once in a while. This is, he says something like, you know what my secret is? I don't care what happens. And it doesn't mean that on a level of form that he's not compassionate, but I'm paraphrasing, you know, I'm going to be projecting my understanding of what he said. But it just means that if we're not invested in the outcome, if our identity has begun to shift from the who we think we are to the what we are that you were just alluding to, Lynn, and speaking to eloquently, that's the who comes and goes. And that changes, you know, moment to moment as well as across a lifetime, as we think of lifetimes. But the what we are, as you mentioned, you know, the first memory that you said you had was really the what. It's the essence that's beyond the who. That the awareness behind the eyes, behind the form, closer than heartbeats or breath, that sees that the illusion can't hide the essence. I mean, it can certainly do an incredibly, you know, vivid and spectacular technicolor holographic high resolution you know, dream of a show to try to get us to think otherwise. But there's that awareness that has never gone away. It's just like in that, you know, lesson, I think it's lesson 182, you know, the little child calls out and says, you know, there's begging you, you know, or asking ceaselessly for us to go home and return to our father's house, you know, and breathe the air that metaphorically that, you know, is there, that to remember that we have that awareness. That soothing, refreshing, completely, eternally comforting peace that we never left. We couldn't possibly have left that. Only in dreams could we have left it. Only in a fake identity of who-ness that feels like it needs to do things. And then this last paragraph starts with the I need do nothing. Well, that's the capital I. It's always addressing the mind. The mind doesn't need to do anything. The physical self, the Bruce and the Lynn and the whoever else is listening, yeah, that self, you know, on the level of behavior appears to need to do a lot of things, and it would be silly to not do the things that are appropriate for the roles that we've taken on. But anyway, do you want to continue?
Yeah, I'll read the last paragraph, and gosh, it's only an hour and 10 minutes, and we've gotten through. I'm kidding. I love this dialogue.
Me too.
You know,
me
really,
too.
You know, the purpose of all this is to, you know, bring about this this knowing in ourselves of the truth about, you know, what we are, and to even shift a perspective a little bit to see that, oh, maybe it's not what I thought it was, really does, you know, change your mind. And, you know, for me, what's happened, and it is, almost kind of like a sudden thing, but gradual, if that makes any sense. And I think about, if you remember, a few years back, they had these, pictures that were called magic eye pictures.
Oh, yes.
Okay. The magic eye pictures, which was like a picture of just something, but that it had something embedded in it that if you looked at it and you could focus your eyes just perfectly, you would actually a 3D image would be there. You would see something that would appear to be floating off the page, and it would be something completely different than what the picture is. So they call it magic eye. And, so when I first saw him, I was at a, Devin has one. I have like four of them here. Well, I first saw it, I was at a Renaissance Fest, and, you know, these people had them, and everybody was looking and going, wow, Uncle. And I was looking and going, what are you talking about? I don't get it. And I didn't get it. And, you know, so, you know, I kept seeing them, and everybody would be just oohing and aahing over them. And so I just kept trying and and reading all the suggestions for how to do it, and never did work. But then just one day I was looking at one, and I got it the right distance from my eyes, and I looked at it, and all of a sudden that image popped up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, oh my God, this is how it works.
I had an almost identical experience. And I like the technical term for those is stereograms. And I like those so much that I put one in my first book toward the back of the book. It's actually a grid, a 2x3 grid of small stellated dodecahedra, is the fancy word for this, the geometrical shape, that if you look at that stereogram I put in the back of Sacred Geometry Design Source Book, you will see what, like you say, when you stare at the page on the focal plane of the paper, you just see a bunch of random black and white dots, you know, and little blobby shapes and very fine textured, grainy, you know, abstract art, because you can't really see anything in there. But then if you there's three dots actually on the top of the page that are helpful so that you can basically focus past the page, which I think is a good metaphor for how those work, is you look past the page to to a point that's several inches behind the plane of the paper, and that's where your eyes focus on a different focal plane, and that's where the software that generates these stereograms kicks in, and you're actually seeing an image that's assembled in your brain that uses the principle of parallax with, you know, how the eyes work in pairs, and puts this image together. And that's how a magic eye or a stereogram works. And there's just some amazing ones out there. You can search on the web for the word stereogram or magic eye, and you'll see a whole bunch of cool ones that you can see on your computer and you'll view them that way. So I'll put some links to some.
The interesting thing, that accident that, I was talking about, and, because what happened at that time, I had a detached retina.
Okay.
And they operated like four different times to try to replace that retina, and it never worked. So I'm completely blind in one eye. And guess what? Those magic eye pictures don't work if you are a cyclops. They only work if you have bifocal vision, which is another great metaphor. That you can't see it with the
that is yeah. I looked at it from a different perspective, but I like that metaphor too, is the perspective of you have to look beyond the surface to something that's deeper in order to see get the bigger picture. And even then we're just getting a partial image, but yeah, I like your metaphor too. That's really cool.
Single vision. So, because it is an illusion, it's all an illusion. And so, we'll play with that later. Anyway, okay. So let's read the last paragraph. And, it's been almost an hour and a half and the water department has not showed up. So, I'll be interested to see how much water, because their sprinklers are still running. I looked out the window and their water is still running back there. So there's, you know, there's a, I think their system is, I think there's a break in their lines. And so it's crazy. So anyway, I mean, it killed my lawn. My lawn is dead. It was like a swamp back there. So this is not so good. Okay, in the eyes of my neighbors who don't want me to have a swampy backyard. Okay, in the section I Need Do Nothing, which is fabulous. If you have not read that and don't know that, please check it out. Jesus teaches us how to walk his unique path of forgiveness, a path that has us quietly peaceful in our minds while busily active in the world. It is not a path of indifference or escapism. One way of describing this approach is to say that we learn to become passive to the ego, but not to the Holy Spirit. So I just pass up what the ego says, and I am only vigilant for God and his kingdom. I'm only vigilant for God and his kingdom, and therefore when I'm looking at in the world, I can look at passively. It doesn't mean that I don't do anything. It's just that I'm not doing it out of a reaction to what I see.
Yeah, so we're a passerby to the ego.
Yeah, exactly. Passive passerby. We're passive to the ego.
I'll pass.
Our peace.
Yeah. Ego, a little more ego on your plate? No, I'll pass.
No, pass it on. I'll pass. Pass the ego. Oh, darn. I got a situation here where I'm going to need a lot of it. So just keep sending it. And I'll. You know, I'll let you know when I've made enough of a mess. So, oh my gosh. All right. So, but anyway, our peace is sustained by our choice to identify with the Holy Spirit's thought system, because then whatever we do will be done through us with no effort or strain on our part. I cannot emphasize this enough. This is when you know that you are not listening to the voice for love when you are acting in the world and doing things. If it's hard, if it's difficult, if I have to try to figure something out, if I know that I'm listening to the voice of the ego. If I am listening to the voice for the Holy Spirit, everything is simple and free and easy. And, I've come to the point, Bruce, where that is just my normal default. If something is not easy, simple, I recognize immediately, I'm trying to do this on my own. I'm not asking for help and I'm not accepting help. I'm trying to do this on my own. And, most of the time when things seem difficult or they seem, distressing or, depressing or anything, is because I think I have to do something. I believe that it is my duty or necessity that I do something. And when I believe that, then I'm going to be trying. And all that trying is doing is generating more and more ego thoughts and emotions and feelings. And when I stop trying, when I recognize, I'm trying to do something, you know, I need to stop and ask for help. And it could be anything, like calling the water department this morning. You know, I knew immediately when I looked out there and I saw all that water, I'm going to have to call the water department. Now, that would entail that I look up the water department's number and I go through, you know, I didn't think that. You know, I just thought, I'll go call the water department. And it was just, and I just let it happen. It was easy as pie to find the number, to call them up, to talk to the person. All that was easy as pie, right? But if I had looked out there, become afraid, said, oh my God, what am I going to do? Woke up the household, woke up my husband, woke up everybody in the house and said, oh, come look. Help me. What do I do? See, I'm looking externally for my answer instead of just asking and then letting myself be led through the process. And being led through the process is so simple. And Jesus tells us, when you have decided to let me choose for you, then not only will you, will I guide you and direct you, I will actually do it for you. There are many, many, many places in the Course where Jesus tells us, I will do this for you. You don't even have to bother. All you have to do is call me, and I'll come help you. I'll do it. And then it's no longer Lynn trying to figure out what to do. It's just a flow of things happening. And the other thing that is so cool about that is he says, it will be so pleasant and so gentle. It will be like being carried down a path on a summer day. You know, you're just being, you're in a stream in a boat, and you're just floating along. That's what, how it is. And anytime you start feeling any kind of upset, you know, I'm splashing around in the stream. I'm trying to get out of the arms of the Holy Spirit. You know, I'm trying to do something on my own. You can't do anything on your own. There's nothing that you can do on your own. You're either doing it with the ego or you're doing it with the Holy Spirit.
Right.
And if you're doing it with the ego, it's going to be painful and difficult. And if you're doing it with the Holy Spirit, it'll be like being carried down a path on a summer day.
And that's our teacher of ease, isn't it? I mean, that's the teacher of the kind-hearted, gentle, simple, easy choice, wherein we don't, like you say, the separate self doesn't have to do anything. In fact, we we just put it on standby and just we can watch its little ticker tape of blather go on the director's cut, but we have the mute button on and we can just kind of be gently amused by that while we, you know, in the driver's seat, we've put our teacher of ease, our teacher of peace and kindness, at the helm. And we're sort of on autopilot at that point. And it's just basically just a relaxed awareness that, like you say, we don't have to do anything. It's done through us. And I think the word through is very helpful here. And I've experienced that a number of times is when you just get the heck out of the way and let that spirit, you know, speak through you and act through you. There's not a lot of busyness in the mind. It's just allowing. And I think, like you say, sometimes in those what we call emergency situations where people come together and help each other and just automatically do the right thing or in the collision situation you talked about, you know, you just sometimes we default to that out of a sense of grace, just allowing ourselves to just do what needs to be done without being invested in the outcome, but out of just, well, this was what was there for me to do, you know, and that's like, there's, like you said, there's no choice involved. It's becomes choiceless choice. It's easy. It's just easy.
It's easy. And I just was thinking of an example of how, of something like that would have probably caused a lot of panic on my part and other people's part. I was staying at Vicky Poppy's house and I was, supposed to be coming back to Colorado, and my flight was early in the morning. So Vicky was taking me to the airport, and there was this huge traffic jam. And so as, you know, we got more and more into this huge traffic jam, you know, of course, time was ticking on. And so actually we got to the point where we were moving so slowly, we were like running out of gas. And so, you know, we got to an exit, went over to a gas station, got gas, got back on the highway, you know, behind all these, you know, other cars. And the whole time, you know, I'm thinking, well, you know, my flight is leaving in XXX and, you know, I'm going to get there, whatever. But it became very clear, after a while that was not going to happen. And, so, you know, Vicky and I just, we prayed, we did our thing. We not prayed, you know, Jesus, help me get to the airport, but, you know, just, you know, help me be peaceful throughout all this and help me know that everything is perfect. And so we did, you know, that's how we were feeling. And we got to the airport and, you know, it was very close to time my flight was going to be boarding. It was really going to be impossible for me to meet my flight, actually. And, so we got to the airport, I got out of the car, you know, got my suitcase, walked into I didn't even get into the airport at Boston Logan. And a fellow, one of the guys that works at the airport says, do you need a wheelchair? 'Cause, you know, he saw me with my cane. And I said, yes, please. A guy was there, boom, with the wheelchair, took me like from the entrance of Boston Logan to the special place at the kiosk to get myself get my boarding pass, mm-hmm. check my bag. I mean, all this stuff. He took me from there to the all the way to the terminal where I was, you know, going to be taking off through uh-huh. security. Pushed, you know, through security, like boom, boom, boom. You know, there were hundreds of people in line, and we were through and down. And I made it to my flight perfect in time, perfect
wow.
in time.
That's
and
great.
At the end, and talking to this guy the entire time, and just having this wonderful conversation with this sweet man from, I think, Lesotho, someplace in Africa.
Uh-huh.
And we got to the gate, and my plane was boarding. In fact, my plane had just finished boarding, and they were kind of waiting for me.
Uh-huh.
Got up there, got out of there, the cart, and this guy says, you know, can I give you a hug? I'm like, yes, of course, you know. We're hugging, all loving. This was literally like being carried down a path on a summer's day. It was
mm-hmm.
literally.
Mm-hmm.
I was literally being carried through something that would have probably taken an hour, you
uh-huh.
know, through, at least.
Sweet story, and a literal and figurative grace, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And that is how your life becomes when you allow the Holy Spirit to do for you. So this is really, really useful information. If that was the only reason you did this, it would be useful. But
yeah.
but obviously you do it because it does shift things in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It does shift things in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't change the script, but it shifts everything. Maybe you shift into a different version of the script in which you're carried through the airport, you know, and it was my choice of how I wanted to be at that moment. And that made all the difference because everybody who I passed by was blessed by my blessing. And that is huge. So,
that's great. That's wonderful. Yeah. And I was thinking as you're saying that, I just kind of did a mental flip of the normal association with the words literal and figurative, because I was thinking that the literal blessing was the sharing that you and this gentleman wheeling you in the wheelchair and everyone that you encountered had on the impact that you had on each other because you were teaching peace. And the figurative was the figures in the dream, which were the bodies of the participants involved. But, you know, so because the literal is the content and the figurative is the form, you know, we're all learning to go back to what we literally are, which is spirit and that essence and the quiet center that this paragraph concludes with. Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yep.
So let's finish this last bit, and looks like we're done. It looks like we're into Devin's time in a minute, so this is perfect. Okay, we become passive to the ego, but not the Holy Spirit. Our peace is sustained by our choice to identify with the Holy Spirit's thought system, because then whatever we do will be done through us with no effort or strain on our part. That is the essence of Jesus' message in this section. This is chapter 18. I need do nothing. To do nothing is to rest and make a place within you where the activity of the body ceases to demand attention. This quiet center in which you do nothing will remain with you, giving you rest in the midst of every busy doing on which you are sent. For from this center will you be directed how to use the body sinlessly. It is this center from which the body is absent that will keep it so in your awareness of it. So this is it. You go to the center where the body is not your concern.
Mm-hmm.
The body is not, you're not afraid for it. You're not worried about it. You're not distressed by it. It's not disturbing you. It is just absent.
Exactly.
And there is peace.
Mm-hmm. When we're in the flow, in the groove, in the mm-hmm. spirit of trusting our inner kindness teacher. Well, thank you so much, Lynn. I like you, we've already mentioned that these are such great reminders for us, and hopefully they've been helpful for anyone who might be listening. So.
Absolutely. And thank you, Bruce. And I will send you this recording as soon as it's done. So thank you, Bruce. Thank you, everybody who joined us. And we're going to hang up and turn the mic over to Devin. Devin, this mic is all yours.